Let's study the Bible together tonight. We are in Daniel chapter 2. It is a lengthy chapter, and we'll try to go at a decent pace, but there's no way we'll finish 49 verses in 30 minutes. So we're going to walk through it together. I've entitled this chapter, Life's Most Important Lesson. Life's Most Important Lesson, and it is to answer the question, who is God? It's life's most important question. And the first part of the answer that everybody has to learn, listen to me, everybody has to learn, is that the answer to the question, who is God, is not me. You really can't learn the answer to the question until you've discerned it isn't you. And you may have to learn that more than once. Some of us need remedial classes. You know, we get down the road a little bit and we think we're in the Lord a good little bit, and somehow we've displaced the Lord, and we've kind of functionally, He's not even an authority to us anymore. We're just doing whatever we want. And so one of the lessons that we have to learn sometimes over and over again is, who is God? And the initial answer has to be, it isn't me. There's a line in the movie Rudy, about the young man who wanted to play football at Notre Dame so badly, and he is having a conversation with a Catholic priest, and he's trying to get the Catholic priest to tell him what he needs to do to solicit God's help so he can play football at Notre Dame. And the Catholic priest's comment is something like this. He said, well, I've been engaged in theological study and trying to be a spiritual man for however many years, and there are two things that I have learned, and I'm certain about them. And the first is, there is a God. And the second thing is, I'm not Him. Well, look, as funny as that is, that's a really good truth. And if you read the Bible and you don't learn that truth, you're not understanding what the Bible teaches. And so that's a very great start. So once you learn that lesson, it's not me, then the question is, well, who is? And I want to say to you that I believe that God has designed life in such a way so that life works to teach us who God is. And often God intervenes in life to help us learn who He is. And I want us to watch Him intervene in the life of Daniel and intervene in the life of Nebuchadnezzar to teach them who God is, who He is. So we're going to observe ways God teaches us that He is God. All right? Ways God teaches us that He is God. Daniel 2, the Bible says, now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. The New Living Translation says, one night during the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had such disturbing dreams that he could not sleep. One of the things that God sometimes does to teach people that He is God is to give them insomnia. They want to sleep, they need to sleep, but they can't sleep. And in the modern age, rather than wondering why it is that the natural order of life, and after you've worked all day, that you lay down and you can't sleep, rather than sorting that out, we take pills to mask it. And what I have often found in the course of my life is that insomnia has been something of a gift from God. He has wanted to speak to me about something, and He's known that in the course of the day when I'm busy and I'm engaged, I don't always hear Him, but when everybody else is asleep in the house, when it's quiet, when I can't risk turning the TV on because I'm going to disrupt somebody, that's the perfect time to talk to Ricky. Maybe you've had similar experiences. Ways God teaches us that He is God, sometimes He takes our sleep. Secondly, Verse number 2, then the king gave the command to call the magicians, the diviner priests, the astrologers, the enchanters or mediums, and the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I have had a dream, and my spirit is anxious, troubled to know the dream. That is, I'm anxious to understand the dream. The New Living Translation says, and I have had a dream that deeply troubles me, and I must know what it means. The second thing that God can do is that God can prompt your search for the truth. God can prompt your search for the truth. In this case, it was a dream. It was something puzzling. It was some difficulty. It was some challenge that Nebuchadnezzar on his own couldn't solve, and the solution wasn't negotiable. The solution was pressing. Sometimes this is the theodicy question. Sometimes this is, why are good people suffering? I don't understand why. And you can't walk away from it because the person who's suffering, maybe it's you. Or maybe it's someone precious to you, and it doesn't make sense. Maybe it's the death of someone you loved, and it was too soon. And you just walk away from that circumstance, and in your heart of hearts, never mind all the spiritual platitudes, but in your heart of hearts, you think, that wasn't right. They should have had more time. Maybe it's the sickness of a child. Maybe it's an economic hardship, but it's something that was outside of your control, and it's come into your life, and you find yourself wondering why, and the answer is not negotiable. You can't just walk away and say it's no big deal. It is a big deal. And so God has prompted your search for truth. Verse number 4, then the Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic. This is likely a bad translation. Let me correct that. It's likely a misapprehension of what is being said in the text. I'm not a Hebrew scholar and I'm not an Aramaic scholar. Okay, so let me just start with that. But the middle section of the book of Daniel is written in Aramaic. And so I think what has happened here is that Daniel wrote originally, then the Chaldeans spoke to the king, and because he changed from Hebrew to Aramaic, he put in parentheses, okay, what's coming next is all going to be in Aramaic. Like, so it's in parentheses as opposed to that they spoke in Aramaic. In all likelihood, they actually spoke in Akkadian, in a kind of dialect that was connected to the Babylonians. But again, the words in the Aramaic are in the text, and that's not awful. It's just probably not what was originally intended. Here's what they say. O king, live forever. Right? It's a politeness, right? It's a person who understands proper decorum, right? The president's name right now is Donald Trump. If you walk up to him and you say Donald Trump, everyone around you is going to say, this person doesn't understand any courtesy or politeness or proper conduct in speech, because that's not what you do. You say, Mr. President. Right? And frankly, people that don't do that probably are deliberately trying to slight the president. So, O king, live forever, right? It's a blessing. You're speaking on the king. Tell your servants the dream and we will give you the interpretation. The New Living Translation says, then the astrologers answered the king, again in Aramaic, I think they answered the king, long live the king, right? Tell us the dream and we will tell you what it means. Well, they say, okay, we're ready. Tell us. Verse 5, the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, "My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces, torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be made an ash heap, a garbage dump. They may be laid in ruins." But the New Living Translation says, "But the king said to the astrologers, 'I'm serious about this. If you don't tell me what my dream was and what it means, you will be torn limb from limb and your houses will be turned into heaps of rubble.'" Now, as I understand this, this is kind of odd from my disposition, but the way that sometimes in Babylon that people were executed is they would take saplings that were close enough together in the forest, and they would bend them all toward a center point, and then they would take that green sapling and they would tie it to a person's limbs. And they would have a rope securing that green sapling, not just the limb, not just that was hooked onto your limbs, and then at simultaneous points, they would cut the limbs and those green saplings would pull your arms and your legs completely off your body. They would stretch them that tight. And so that was the way that people were, they were executed, exactly. So this appears to be the threat. The other thing is, sometimes when a person fell into disfavor from the king, they literally made the person's house a place to throw trash. So they didn't knock the house down. They literally killed everybody in the house and made it known, everybody in public, that you can throw your trash in that house. And so the king is saying, you're going to kill you and we're going to ruin your reputation if you don't do what I want you to do. And to be clear, the Chaldeans want the king to tell them, okay, tell us about the dream and we'll interpret them. But the king has said, nope, we're not doing what we normally do. I'm not telling you the dream and then you interpret it. You're going to have to tell me what the dream is and interpret it. I'm not going to tell you what the dream is. We're going to get to that in just a moment. Verse 6, however, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation. The New Living Translation says, but if you tell me what I've dreamed and what the dream means, I will give you many wonderful gifts and honors. Just tell me the dream and what it means. They answered again and said, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will give its interpretation. The New Living Translation, again, they say again, please, your majesty, tell us the dream and we will tell you what it means. The king answered and said, I know for certain that you would gain time. That is, you're stalling. That's the way we would say it. You're stalling. You're trying to gain time because you see that my decision is firm, that it's final. The New Living Translation says, the king replied, I know what you're doing. You're stalling for time because you know I am serious when I say. So they're negotiating. They're hoping that the king will change his mind, that if they prevail, that eventually the king will tell them the dream and then they'll get to provide the interpretation. Verse 9, if you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree. There is only one sentence for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. That is, you have conspired to tell me something false or fraudulent until the situation changes. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation. The New Living Translation says, if you don't tell me the dream, you are doomed. So you have conspired to tell me lies, hoping I will change my mind. But tell me the dream, and then I'll know you can tell me what it means. King Nebuchadnezzar appears to have developed some discernment. he appears to have looked at the situation and said, you know, these guys, every time I have some kind of dream and I give them this dream, and then that I say, you have the assignment of interpreting the dream, they come back with some gobbledygook, some generic nonsense that I can't sort out what it means. So I don't know if what they've given me is actually an interpretation to the dream or not, or it's in such generic cookie cutter Chinese fortune cookie kind of stuff that there's always some sense in which it's going to be true. And so he's saying to them, that isn't going to happen this time. I'm not going to create a situation where you can make up some gibberish and there's some possibility that it's going to be true just out of sheer luck. I'm making the situation more difficult because I'm not going to allow you to do that. And I'm suspicious that's what you've been doing in the past, and so I'm not going to allow you to do that again now. How God teaches us that He is God, a way that He does that. God can make you feel the weight of uncertainty. God can make you feel the weight of uncertainty so that you exercise discernment about truth claims. It's an annoying question when you have a toddler and they ask it over and over and over again. And it's one of two versions. They either ask you the question, why, over and over and over again, or they ask you the question, how do you know? How do you know? How do you know? How do you know? And at some point you want to say, I know because I know. Like, enough's enough. But when people don't exercise appropriate discernment and they don't entertain the question, how do you know, at all, they're given to silliness. They're given to nonsense. They're establishing life and its meaning on nothing. And Nebuchadnezzar at this point has enough angst about this dream that he has had that he doesn't want just any interpretation. He wants the right interpretation. There's a whole discipline of philosophy that deals with the question, how do you know? That field of philosophy is called epistemology. Look, it does matter how you know, right? And in Christian circles, with respect to the Bible, there are all kinds of facts about the Bible that would help you to have confidence in it. Right? Those would be a kind of objective epistemology. It's just true. Like the scope over which the Bible was written, how many authors were involved, how much continuity there is in the message of the Bible, how often the Bible condemns the same things and celebrates the same virtues. All of that is objective material that could be used to help build confidence in the Bible. The other thing that happens is what's called subjective epistemology, and that is you read the Bible and the living God who wrote it, speaks to you. He communes with you. He directs you. He convicts you. He guides you. He inspires you, and you find out, wait a minute, when I read this Bible and I understand it, I'm not just connecting with my own thoughts. I'm actually connecting with the author. And he's the God of the universe. And so there is both objective epistemology, support for the Bible, and there is subjective epistemology, support for the Bible. In this case, Nebuchadnezzar says, no, you'll forgive me if you don't like this, but he says, I'm putting an end to any possibility that this is a shuck and jive show. I'm not doing it. I'm shutting the door on that happening. Verse 10, then the Chaldeans answered the king and said, listen to this, this is fascinating. They say, there is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter, that is, who can meet the king's demand. Therefore, no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such thing of any magician, astrologer, medium, or Chaldean. The New Living Translation says, the astrologers replied to the king, no one on earth can tell the king his dream. And no king, however great or powerful, has ever asked such a thing of any magician, enchanter, or astrologer. Again, at this point, I want to say that if I were to translate this unkindly, the astrologers are all saying, look, you guys are all been a bunch of suckers, and we want you to keep being a bunch of suckers. And this kind of request is going to keep us from being able to pull the wool over your eyes one more time. Verse 11, it is a difficult thing that the king requests. And there, listen to this, and there is no other who can tell it to the king, listen to this, except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. The New Living Translation says, the king's demand is possible. No one except the gods can tell you your dream, and they do not live here among people. Now, wait a minute. These advisors, these magicians, these diviner priests, these astrologers, these mediums, these sorcerers, these Chaldeans, isn't that what they claimed? Didn't they claim, hey, we have a connection to the gods, and that's how we can tell you what your dream means? But when push comes to shove, they make it clear, no, wait a minute, we don't have the kind of connection with the gods that we need to have in order to do what you want us to do. I don't know if you've ever had one of these conversations, but I have, and they're really frustrating. Where you're listening intently to somebody, they say something and you repeat the words back to them that they just said, and they say, no, that's not what I said. Like, nope, I was just listening to you. I heard what you just said. That is what you just said. Now, if it wasn't true and you want to take it back, that's okay, but I heard you. I've had them with children through the years. I dare say that some of them may actually have a slight breath of relief when I am gone, because they'll know they won't have to have another one of those conversations. Because this, just so you know, Brother Ricky hates deceit. I hate lying. I'm good with all kinds of other struggles and trials and difficulties, but I can't stand a liar. And frankly, if I find out you are one, I'll be nice to you, but you're not going to be my friend. And I'm not going to be yours. I'm going to keep my distance until you figure out how to stop that. And I love my children, but I don't tolerate that. And I'm not nice about it. I don't say, I think maybe you made a mistake. I will say, okay, I don't feed liars. Don't do that to me. Yeah, right. I did warn you. Yeah, you'll want to take this one to heart. I'm not going to change my mind at this point. Nebuchadnezzar's caught them in a lie, hasn't he? They have been willing to perpetuate a fraud on him and to him and against him. And he's now said, I'm not tolerating the possibility that that's what you've been doing all these years. I'm shutting the door on that. It's interesting that God in this case is actually teaching the, listen to me, God is teaching the magicians, the diviner priests, the sorcerers, the enchanters, the mediums, the Chaldeans. He's teaching them that he's God. How is he doing that? He's making them face their own limitations. You know, there are things I cannot do. I just can't do them. Some of them I am tempted to try, but they don't turn out well. And at this point now, with wisdom on my side, I've stopped doing that. And so when I need help to accomplish something, I don't just go, you know, I solicit the kind of help I need. And many of you have perhaps been the recipient of one of those phone calls. ways that God teaches us that He is God, He can make us face our limitations. He might do that with health. He might do that with money. He might do that with a relationship you can't fix. But he will create circumstances in your life that make it clear you're not running the universe. In fact, not only are you not running the universe, you're not even running this space right here around you. And so God sometimes does that to teach us that we are not Him. We got time for one more point. Let's cover it. Verse number 12. For this reason, the king was angry and very furious. The Holman Christian Standard Bible says he was violently angry. That sounds right. And he gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. All right, the New Living Translation says the king was furious when he heard this, and he ordered that all the wise men of Babylon be executed. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men. That is, the wise men were about to be killed. So the order is kind of standing, they're gathering them up, they're getting ready to have a massive slaughter of these people. And they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Well, they were considered part of that group. They were part of the ruling elite. They were the advisors of the king. Right, verse 13, and because of the king's decree, men were sent to find Daniel, to find and kill Daniel and his friends. Well, this isn't going well. Verse 14, then with counsel, that is with prudence, with tact and wisdom, discretion, Daniel answered Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who'd gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. The New Living Translation says, when Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, came to kill them, Daniel handled the situation with wisdom and discretion. That would be like the opposite of panic, right? You're here to kill me. Well, why are you here to kill me? Well, you're part of the wise men. Well, why are the wise men being killed? Well, he answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king so urgent? Why is it so harsh? Then Arioch made the decision known. He explained the situation to Daniel. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time, to appoint him a time, to give him some time, more time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. Related to the point we just made, how does God teach us that we are not God and that He is? God can expose your lack of sovereignty. God can show you just how much of your life, even your own life, is outside of your control. It is fascinating that often the way God teaches us about Himself is through contrast. First, He shows us who we are, and then He shows us that He's not like us. He doesn't have our limitations. It's a great place for us to finish tonight. Let me just review our thoughts so far. Life's most important lesson, who is God? First, the answer has to be not me. Okay, well then who is? God. Then we find out ways that God teaches us that He is God. First, God can take your sleep. Secondly, God can prompt your search for truth. Third, God can make you feel the weight of uncertainty so that you exercise discernment about truth claims. Some of the things you believed, they shouldn't be believed. They should be discarded. They're not true. Fourth, God can make you face your limitations. Fifth, God can expose your lack of sovereignty. God can show you just how much of life, even your own life, is outside of your control. I hope God has blessed the study and meditation and preaching of His Word. We'll pick up in verse 17 next time. Let's pray together. Lord, I like this because I find it applicable when I leave this place. Sorting out to what degree that I functionally act like that I am my own God and that I can run my own life and I can make my own decisions. And it relates to what degree I think I'm self-sufficient. And it's a kind of American-styled idolatry that we kind of have to sort out and reject. And it isn't something that we get to reject like a physical statue. It's something we have to reject day after day after day because it's ideological. It's the kind of beliefs that they're just in the air we breathe. And so I pray, Lord, that you would make this message and the truths that are in it a kind of scalpel that helps to remove that American-styled idolatry. Just cuts it out of our hearts, cuts it out of our lives, that we're clear that we're not you, we're not God, and that we're open to seeing just how much more magnificent you are than we are. Speak to our hearts in these final moments as we reflect on the truths that we've studied here tonight. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.